So, quite a tricky reading this morning, and one I've picked deliberately for that reason. But before we think about that, just to put the next few weeks in context. So for the next few Sundays, rather than having a straightforward sermon, we are going to be getting you to think between yourselves about the scripture that we're hearing and what we see Jesus doing, so that we can turn to scripture for guidance on where we're going as a community, on what the church should be doing, what it should be turning towards, what it should be turning away from, and all of the questions that we're currently considering. We haven't forgotten the post-it notes. We have collected those in. We are reflecting on them, and we will come back to them. We're wondering, should we have some kind of a way morning, or should we? How are we going to proceed with that? But that's a work in progress. So this is a chance for you to bring your own thoughts to what you were hearing for a few weeks. And the passage this morning raises as many questions as answers, really. We've got this story of a real outsider, and I have never quite decided what I think about it all. So I'm genuinely looking forward to what thoughts you bring to it. But before you have time to talk to each other, I'm going to give you a few pointers and chuck out a few interesting bits and pieces to get you kind of thinking and a few things for thought. So, this story is not set in the same area that most of Jesus' parables are. At the start of the story, you heard Stephen say, Jesus crossed over. He went across the water, and he went into a different part of the territory. And where he went was on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. So I should be going that way. And it's moving out of Jewish heartlands into the area called Decapolis, which just means 10 cities. Polis is city, Deca is 10. So 10 cities. And these were 10 very Hellenistic cities. And what we mean by that is that culturally, unlike where Jesus was from and had been shaped, these are very Roman and Greek culture cities. He's going from his own culture into a different culture. And he doesn't have to do that. We think about Paul as the apostle to the Gentiles, but this is a point where Jesus is already reaching out beyond boundaries into different groups of people. So that's one thing. Another thing, you probably spotted that the demoniac, he sees Jesus and he names him immediately. He knows that this is Jesus and this is the Son of the Most High. I mean, how many people in the Bible actually do that? His own disciples seem to struggle getting their head around that one. And yet this person who is completely beyond the pale, he's living in a cave, he's hitting himself with rocks, he's chained up, he sees Jesus and he knows him. That's another thing to reflect on. Also, there is an interesting dynamic in the story between the people in the town and this guy. So at the start of the story, the people in the town are quite happily getting on with their lives, and they're quite happy for him to sit in his cave on his own, hurting himself. They try and chain him up and he breaks it, but he seems to leave them alone. But they seem content with that arrangement. They don't try and intervene. At the end of the story, we hear that they're afraid and they are begging Jesus to go away. And that's always struck me as profoundly odd. That you'd have thought they'd have been like, brilliant, this guy who was always a problem, he was like social pariah, he was a real misfit, and now he's back in town with us behaving like everybody else, this is fantastic. And that is the opposite of what they do. Now, lots of people have written lots of things about this, but one way that you can read this is that the townspeople actually needed this guy as someone to look down on. And in every time and culture, we've always found people that we go, you are less than. We can be confident in who we are because you're less than us. And we come up with names and justifications and all kinds of stuff to justify that. But this is an example where Jesus is bringing a spotlight on that and questioning it. And saying, were you right to be doing that to him? Were you right to just be pushing him to the edge and pointing the finger at him? And at the end, Jesus has changed that whole status quo. There's another interesting question about the name of the town. So different manuscripts in the early church use different names in this story. And it crops up in three Gospels and it's in different places. So we know that people have been tweaking where this was set. And there's usually a reason for that. So it's thought that the story was originally located at Gadara. And in some versions you hear about the Gadarene swine, the pigs from Gadara, who end up with the evil spirits. But Mark relocates it to Gersera, which is another place in a similar part of the country, similar name. But he's made a decision there, and there's got to be some reason he did that. And Gersera was a town that had recently been in the news in a way that chimed with the events of the passage. So, there had been an uprising in this town against the Romans who were occupying, as you know. And the historian Josephus, who talks a lot about the history of this area, says that this was put down brutally. 1,000 people in this town, which is probably basically the whole town, were slaughtered. And the surrounding villages were destroyed, as well as the town. So the Romans didn't mess around. If you tried questioning their rule, that was their response. That was how they kept order. So when you come back to this story and you think, why did Mark move it to that place? It seems that he's drawing a parallel between the occupying Roman troops, also called legions, which is the term he uses for the spirits in this story, and the evil spirits who begged Jesus not to send them out of the country. And when we think that the Messiah was seen at that time as someone who would free the country from the evil occupation of the Romans, this starts to come together quite nicely. And not only that, but the spirits who get put in the pigs, the words that they have in Greek to talk about what happens to those pigs are commanded and charge, which are two words which are linked with military actions at that time. So he's using words like, I don't know what we'd have now, battalions and take out or offensive or target. The kind of words that you only usually hear to do with military things, he's using for these pigs. And so I wonder, is Mark telling a story on different levels? And one of the levels is that the possessed man is actually a symbol for Israel. Israel has been chained up, it's been put in a cave equivalently, it's been cast out of the mainstream of the culture. And it was chained in Egypt and it broke free, and the Babylonians and it broke free. So like this man, there's a history of it being mistreated and then freeing itself. And is the story about Jesus coming to free Israel and bring it back into a full life again? Because stories can tell you different things at the same time. It can both be about an exorcism of a man, and it can be about Israel, and it doesn't have to be either or. He can use both of those together and have different levels of meaning. And Jesus' final instruction to the demoniac is also interesting. Jesus tells him to go back to the town, to all the people who had not tried to help him when he was in trouble, and who had just bound him up and left him to rot. So this is the last place that the healed man wants to go back to. These are the people who have mistreated him and didn't care, and who think that he's rubbish and nothing, and it doesn't matter what happens to him. But Jesus is insistent. He commissions him as a missionary to the very people who thought they had it all sewed up and that he was the problem. And he says, go back to them and show them what mercy looks like. The man has experienced the mercy of Jesus and it has changed his life. He has understood what Jesus actually wants for his people. And he's saying, you are now an image of what salvation. Salvation in Greek just means healing. You are an image of what a healed life looks like. And in looking at you, the townspeople see how far short they've fallen of that. They see how the way that they have treated you is so unacceptable compared to the mercy of God which they are called to show to people. And so go back and be a living image of what I want for people and teach them what that mercy looks like. And that is the ultimate empowerment that he could give. Not only does he save him, he heals him. He gives him a new life. But then he raises him up to be his apostle back into the town. So to finish with, before you start thinking about this in your groups, a comment on demons from C.S. Lewis. It's a topic that can polarise people. Some people think it's all rubbish, some people get very, very thinking about it a lot. C.S. Lewis comments, there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. So he's warning us, don't revolve your whole faith around demons and get completely wrapped up in it. But don't fall into the trap of just thinking this is something that isn't there at all. And find some kind of middle path is what he's advising. So, although this is a fascinating passage generally, I encourage you in your groups to focus on how it gives guidance in relation to the specific question of where the future of St. Augustine lies, if we are to be a Jesus-shaped community attempting to live Jesus-shaped lives. We want to be like the town at the end of the story, after we've seen it, who are living into that place of mercy, showing God's mercy to people. In case you were worrying that there's a right answer, or you think that we have already got a sense of what we want you to find in the passage, and now we're going, go and find the thing we want you to find, that's not what's happening. One of the reasons I picked this passage is that it's got so many unanswered questions for me. And so I'm very interested to see what you come up with in your groups, thinking about how it speaks into St. Augustine. So Patrick in a minute is going to come around and give out the text. And I suggest that you start by getting into groups of three or four and just reading the passage back. Get one of you to read it back to you so it's really fresh in your mind. And then there's a few questions to think about. And if I give you about 10 minutes, we'll see how you're going. If you seem totally engrossed, we might have a couple more minutes. If you seem to have said what you've got to say, we'll draw it back and there'll be a chance to feed back anything that struck you. And then we'll wrap up. So, any questions? Does that make sense? So, groups of three or four, you're going to get the text, read the text again, and then have a think about what you see in that. What does this say that Jesus is calling us as a community to do? So, any thoughts that have arisen as part of your discussions that you want to share? Any insights or any questions that got raised for you by it that you feel like you still haven't figured through yet? I know, wandering around, there were some really good discussions going on. There's no, you don't have to feed back. So I know that there's been some really interesting points coming up.
I think a very interesting point was made that it's often the people who've been excluded and suffered that understand other people's suffering and exclusion. And that's a real gift that people can bring to any community. So why is it that, you know, ex-homeless people are often the best at understanding the needs of homeless people? Ex-drug addicts are the best people to help those going through it. And I think a point was made in our group about how sometimes it's the people, again, who have been excluded and suffering that can see the suffering in others. And it's being able to listen. Because sometimes people don't feel, if you're the person that's being pushed down, you don't feel that you are going to be listened to, so you don't say the kind of important stuff that the community sometimes needs to hear. that can enrich us all. And I think it's saying to people, please speak up and say what you feel and think.
Just sorry, I'm going to. But I think there is a slight issue when we say we want people to speak up. We're putting all of the onus on the people that we've spent generations pushing down. And actually, if we then want to reverse that and hear those voices and get them to actually trust the church enough to speak into these spaces, then we need to actively empower them. It's not enough to go, well, we've been kind of saying you're less than for all this time, and now you need to speak up. Actually, we need to do the work.
I think that was generally the point. You put it better than I was doing it, yeah.
And one thing that I looked at quite a bit last year when I was doing my training and my dissertation was the way that the church selection procedures of who gets to stand in this space and do the talking as opposed to being in that space and kind of being talked at a lot of the time, and how that is tweaked towards the people who are in power in society anyway, and how that is the opposite of what Jesus did. And time and time again, we see Jesus walking away from the people in power in society to the people who aren't in power and giving them a voice, and how the church really needs to look more at that model of how you get Jesus' message out through the people who have received his mercy, which is kind of what, Herman, you were saying, which Patrick has then kind of fed back, but that was your point, I think. And it's so... We seem to be at crossroads in the church. Are we going to go and become more Jesus-centred, or are we just going to keep doing the same old, and getting the same small pool of people up at the front doing the talking? And to me, that's what this passage is partly talking about. So, to sum up, the underlying issue in this story that we have heard is those other people. It's the main issue that runs through the New Testament from beginning to end. The question is, how do the wrong kind of people wind up being the right kind of people? And obviously, when I say the wrong kind of people, I'm talking from the position of the prejudiced majority, not from the position of Jesus. How does that happen where God is concerned? And what does that mean from our own attitudes to the right kind of people around us? And what about when we find that we are not actually the right kind of people after all, and we need to be the recipients of the missionary actions of the wrong sort, who turn out to be the ones able to recognise and name Jesus at 100 paces, like the healed demoniac who ministered to the town? So how do we as a church get the humility to listen to those voices and empower those voices to speak to us, bringing us the sweet news of Jesus' mercy to heal our own selves? So there's lots of food for thought about where we are headed as a church, and there will be lots more in the coming weeks. And thank you so much for your full participation in that discussion, which was there's so many good points being made. Thank you.